Ahoy, hoy.
I don't know what that is.
Don't worry about it. It's fine.
is that from your Doctor Who?
No. Let's move past that.
Yeah, well, you've been writing a lot about Doctor Who. I mean, apparently I didn't like click the links. It might have just been like a link big headline or something. I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's one of those things where, you know, I just start off writing a little thing and I'm like, I'm just going to, you know, explain something in a little longer than a tweet about why I don't like something. And then like 20,000 words later, you know, it is what it is.
The yak is shaved and you've backed up to finally explain what a television show is.
Yeah, I talked about 5 episodes specifically, and it was as if that wasn't enough. Then at the end of it, I felt compelled to make a story out of all of the terrible things from the episodes that I didn't like as sort of a fan fiction conglomeration of horribleness at the very end of it. So it's just like this one big, long, terrible thing. And it's a shame, really. Like, it's just not a good season so far. So.
So what you're saying is a hole has been left in the screenplay fan fiction world since you started your own podcast and you were just jonesing so hard that you had to write some more yourself.
Well, I have a podcast that I've been meaning to write something about. I just haven't gotten around to it yet. But this just...
I think I know which one.
Which one?
The one with the feelings?
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know what to do with that one yet. I was going to do like a buddy cop thing where they're like feelings cops and they like go around and make everybody... understand what they're doing on the internet is making people feel bad, or they help people feel justified in their decisions based on like feeling loan sharks.
It sounds like a prequel to Equilibrium, if I'm honest.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, it's
gonna turn
like,
really dark in the third act.
No, it was more like a good like happy touchy feelings, not like a oppress all feelings and destroy the world kind of thing. So different slant.
It's not going to end with a computer saying the only winning move is to not play, and then, you know, you just remove all emotions from everyone all the time.
How did we get to War Games?
It's, you know, same thing.
No.
I'm tired.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, my brain's not working full speed. I mean, even on a good day, it's not full speed, but, you know.
Well, what percentile of your normal speed is it running?
Simultaneously probably 50 and 175.
Okay, so you've got multiple cores.
Yes. One of them is going too fast and it is producing a bit of like a burnt rubber smell, and the other part is just like throwing its hands up in the air saying I give up.
So overclock and underclock, you know. Am I too close to the metal right now?
Over under, yeah.
Yeah.
Doing an over under.
Yeah, one goes under, one goes over. So what?
So what?
Oh boy.
What are we even doing?
I don't know. I never know what we're doing.
Right out of the gates.
Yes.
Off to a fantastic... Oh my God, it's only been 3 minutes.
Yep. It happens. Tempus fugit. Time flies.
Tempus is... That's a Doctor Who thing, right?
No, that's Latin.
Oh. I only know one phrase in Latin.
What's that?
The one we all learned from Bionic.
Oh.
And if I recall, we learned the wrong definition as well. So.
Yes. I was going to say, so we didn't really learn anything that day.
Yeah, probably not.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's other things you should know, like, you know, quid pro quo, I messed that one up. Quid pro quo, Clarice.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's the movie where he eats the guy's face.
Yes, with fava beans and a nice Chianti.
And the guy from Monk is like super creepy with his hair.
Mm-hmm. The guy from Monk makes it around.
He's all over the place. Where did I just see him recently? He was in... No, that wasn't him. Never mind. It was that other guy.
Fascinating.
I watched 12 Years a Slave yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
I'm finally catching up on last year's Oscar movies.
I haven't seen it yet. I'm not sure if I have managed to put myself in the mood where I can endure the movie.
Yeah, it's I kind of just had to, you know, grit my teeth and hit play. Same thing, Dallas Buyers Club, watched that last week too.
See, I can't, I haven't done that one either. I basically can only watch things above a certain, like, horrible humanity threshold.
Yeah, well.
Yeah.
It's better to get them out of the way now instead of, like, doing them all at once in Oscar season, I think, because then it's just overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, depression for the holidays, really.
Yeah, wow.
The Oscar holidays.
That's our holiday, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's
the time we all gather around the television and watch them barely mention visual effects.
Yes, our people our people eat every part of the Oscar.
Oh God!
And visual I'm effects, not sure. Man.
Yeah, that's a thing.
We don't have any new visual effects news this week, do we?
Fortunately, no.
No. There's a new camera out. Did you see that? You don't follow cameras, do you?
No.
It's going to make visual effects very unhappy. It signals the return of 65 millimeter, but in digital form.
I'm confused.
You know, film is 35 millimeter, mostly.
Yeah.
65 millimeter is an old thing where it's a lot bigger.
That wasn't CinemaScope. That was something else, right? I'm actually really not that up on actual film formats. I know 35 millimeter. I know VistaVision. I know that stuff, but
it's probably closer to well, bigger than VistaVision. It's basically IMAX digital form, but
I thought IMAX was 75.
I think it's 7D, but somewhere between 65, 70, all those large frame formats are basically the same as medium format stills cameras. And Arri took their award-winning Alexa digital camera and slapped three sensors in them in portrait mode side by side and turned it into a 65 millimeter camera.
Yikes.
And rehoused a bunch of Hasselblad lenses. So now we have 6.5K Arri RAW that I'm sure a lot of people are going to want to get their hands on because the Alexa is already a wonderful camera to use.
But wait. Sure. But wait. The three sensors. Aren't you at risk of one of them not being exactly in tune with the other sensors?
It was explained in the press release that the sensor is built out of three Alexa sensors in portrait mode, seamlessly stitched together. I don't know if they're doing the stitching in the digital signal processing. I assume they did the stitching when they manufactured the chip on, the wafer. So, yeah. Presumably, it's just, yeah, they made a bigger one and they're just describing it as such.
Yeah, I just can't wait for the, you know, somebody shooting something and the bottom one third of the image is blue.
Yeah, that would be a terrible hack. And I don't think they would really. Although, I mean, you can't even buy this camera. It's only for rental and there's probably like two of them, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's a shockingly compelling 6.5K camera.
Mm-hmm.
Less about the 6.5K and more about the sensor size, because as I'm sure you're aware, bigger sensor, narrower depth of field, and everyone loves narrow depth of field.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And how.
That'll be fun. Yeah. Maybe it'll finally convince Christopher Nolan to give digital a shot.
He hasn't shot anything digital before?
I'm not going to say never because I don't want the correction emails, but he is, he's the one standing up saying, I love film and everyone should be behind film because film is great. And one of his big sticking points is because he shoots a lot of stuff IMAX too, because he likes the larger substrate. And, up until now, there hasn't been a, digital process close to IMAX. So theoretically this could fit that niche for him.
Mm-hmm.
Although he just, you know. He's another one of those film is better because I said so people.
Well, what do you expect? Directors, right?
Yeah, they're the worst.
Mm-hmm. And how?
Yeah. Not like me, the producer over here.
Mm-hmm. So are you technically a producer on your project thing?
Depends on which one you're talking about, but yeah.
Well, I don't know which one am I talking about. I don't know which one I should talk about.
I'm not sure this podcast has government clearance to talk about the ones that
you'll
we
to
need
kill
to talk
me.
About. Yeah, if I tell you, I'll have to kill you.
And all of the listeners?
All of our listeners, which I'll track you down by IP address.
No, this is really hard, Dan.
Yeah, I'm in the midst of producing one and doing post work on another, and then post work on another.
Okay, say no more. The thought of thought of all of our listeners being mercilessly slaughtered makes no sense to me.
It might be a mercy killing of a certain degree. No, there were 10
look on
minutes
the bright
into
side.
This.
You don't have to listen to this podcast anymore. Yay!
Hooray! Well, I mean, apparently most of the people who, well, at least a couple of the people on Twitter who look at the announcements of our movies don't actually listen to the podcast, which is nice. It's like a Cliff's Notes version. They go, oh, well, cool, they're doing that movie this week, so I guess I don't have to listen now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's what we're here for.
to announce
people.
Things not to be listened to.
Yeah.
It's like we're Microsoft or BlackBerry or something. Like, we announce things and then people don't have to actually partake. Because the announcement is the event, right?
Well, I was going to say, it's kind of like a movie trailer. Those little 140 character tweets about what we're going to watch the upcoming week that we send out usually at the very end of a weekend.
So you think people look at our tweets and then they look over at the person sitting next to them while they're shoveling popcorn in their mouth and they go, I think I'll skip that one.
Yes. Yes.
Wait till it comes out on video.
It is on video. They're all on video. They're mostly from the 90s.
Video on demand.
Speaking of video, it just occurred to me that, well, not just occurred to me, but one thing I had been meaning to talk to you about is how absolutely terrible streaming video is, because it never has anything that I want on it, and it upsets me greatly. It is a fragmented, crappy system, and it bothers me.
It's almost like the people in charge are making deals with dozens upon dozens of license holders and copyright holders.
Yeah, and then they're all jerks, because I wanted to watch Galaxy Quest streaming in HD, and I couldn't do it. So you know what I did, Dan?
You probably put a DVD in a DVD player.
Oh, yeah. Widescreen DVD.
Got to make sure get the widescreen there.
Mm-hmm. And if you got close to the screen, you could see like little interlace lines. It was really nice. So that was nice. And it's one of those holdovers I had from, you know, you used to go to Walmart in college and you'd buy whatever DVD was on sale for $9, and then you'd watch the crap out of that for 2-3 months or whatever, and then circle back to it every now and then on your $60 DVD player and your 19-inch CRT television. Or you'd go to the university's library and you'd check out a DVD to go watch at home.
It will probably surprise you to know I didn't spend a lot of time in my university's library.
Too busy playing lacrosse, huh?
No, not. Well, that was only the first year in college. After that, it was just hanging out in the post-production lab.
But didn't all the film nerds go down to the library and get all the nerdy film stuff? Weren't you guys all like getting the DVD set for Dr. Zhivago?
My film school was in a community college, so no. It was mostly people would sit on like a little table outside the equipment checkout area and smoke cigarettes and talk about their short films.
We had our campus had a very tiny library, and inside of the very tiny library were some books that nobody would touch, and then there was a DVD selection, which we'd basically use as our personal Blockbuster. And the DVD selection was not great, and they didn't have multiples of anything. So if your choice wasn't there, then so what? To find anything, you had to use a Sun all-in-one terminal with Solaris on it. And it was just basically a Netscape Navigator browser in Solaris.
Solaris, that's that movie with George Clooney, right?
Oh, God, it's so bad. I hate that movie so much. I saw that in theaters. What a waste of my life.
Do you hate it more or less than the Solaris terminal to look up your DVDs?
More than. I would rather use the pastel and gray terminal to do this. But you'd have to look it up on there, and then you go find the ISBN number and whatever, and you go find where it is in the shelving system and the crappy plastic box they put it in and see how scratched it was, and you check it out. And then you'd forget to return it and have to pay a fine.
God, this is prescient for so many reasons. I actually just went by my old college last week, just to stop by and say hi. I was in the neighborhood and went to go see who's still working there. And I learned about which teachers had a nervous breakdown and left, and which ones are still there but about to retire. And, you know, they got another building with the couple more computers. They're all on IMAX now. They got a fancy new equipment rental area and a bunch of fun new stuff.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it was weird to see some people who hadn't moved in 12 years and some people who were long, long gone.
Mm.
It got a little odd that the story that was being described to me about what had happened to the person who was in charge of the post-production facilities, the word Machiavellian came out pretty early in the power struggle discussion, and I got very confused as to what happens in academia these days, because I guess I wouldn't fight that hard over my position in a faculty, but apparently it's a thing.
I've heard as much about things similar to that from sources about stuff. So it's exciting.
Well, it's just, you know, I used to work there on like Saturdays from like 8 a.m. to like 1 p.m. Just like I would be the tech in the Avid lab when people had a question. And really, it was mostly
what is
snacks.
Avid?
What is Avid?
No, that was the question. You would mean like it. That was
No. Oh my God, no.
That was my joke.
No, it was mostly like
I know what Avid is.
It was mostly like, why is it not recognizing my drive? But I basically spent my time eating stuff out of the vending machine, trying not to fall asleep, which, I mean, I mostly fell asleep. And then people would knock on the little door where I was sleeping and I would wake up and go fix their Avid. But apparently it's gotten more interesting since I left. And I learned that they have the Foundry Production Collective there. So that's pretty fancy. They're all learning Nuke and Moto and Mari and stuff.
Exciting.
Yeah. And back in my day, it was just Apple Motion 1.0.
Wow.
That was our compositing class was Apple Motion.
Wow.
The book came out like the Apple Certified Training book came out like a week before the class started. So we basically just went through page by page and we did I still remember the goofy tutorial. It's some woman who was on green screen who like opens her hand and a bunch of like animated butterflies come flying out. And we were using the particle system to make variations in butterflies that flew away. I still have the book around here somewhere. I may have thrown that away actually, but That was my fun post-production experience in college.
Sounds really thrilling.
Yeah. There's also a nice new natural sciences building behind the film school now, and they have a big aquarium. I went and looked at some fish.
An aquarium?
Yeah.
For why? Wait, why?
In the natural sciences building.
But for, like, educational purposes or just for decoration?
I assume it's for educational purposes, but who knows?
Oh, well, that's
actually, you know where the Natural Sciences Building is? It's in the place of the former lacrosse field.
Oh, okay. What happened to the lacrosse field? They got a newer, better one?
No, it's buried under concrete now, or maybe they just let him play over on the football field now.
Hmm.
I assume they still have a football team. Good old fighting artichokes.
I'm sorry, what?
We were the artichokes.
I'll repeat my question. I'm sorry, what?
The film school I went to was in Scottsdale, the Scottsdale Community College. It was the only film school in Phoenix when I went. And yeah, Scottsdale Community College's mascot is the fighting artichoke. They have a guy who walks around in a big artichoke suit.
Wow, that's really something.
Yeah, it's fascinating is what it is.
My school had a mascot, but we didn't have any sports at all, whatsoever to speak of. But some donor had decided the school ought to have a mascot, so she donated money on the condition that the school adopt a mascot, and so it was Rembrandt the Armadillo. So we had that. I mean, no person was walking around in an armadillo suit or anything, but ostensibly, there was armadillo stuffed animal plushies you could buy at the bookstore to represent.
That's fascinating. See, and like back in when I was in, I guess it was elementary school, since I live in the middle of the desert, they had yet to build the middle school that we were going to go to. So we all voted on what the mascot should be for the school they were building that we would go to next year. And I almost managed to convince all of the people in the class to, I think we actually may have had the winning vote for the Flying Pigs, but the administration refused to name the mascot the Flying Pigs, so we ended up being the Panthers.
That's really something.
yeah, I was able to, you know, to rally the fifth graders behind the Altadena Flying Pigs. But ultimately, we were usurped by 40-year-old people in suits.
Those suits, they just don't understand.
Yeah, how dare they?
Yeah, they don't understand the Flying Pigs. Okay. I'm trying to think of how we can segue to the movie, and I'm at a loss.
Yeah. Oh, wait, Oh, I was going to mention that I got my Super Nintendo hooked back up, and it is hooked up to a lovely old CRT just for nostalgia's sake.
Well, that's probably for the best, because I've noticed that hooking up those old consoles to more modern playback devices does not yield the kind of visual experience that I would like.
You mean like gigantic pixels that you can see?
Well, it's just that the pixels are so sharp and clear, as opposed to on a CRT monitor, where it just kind of fuzzes it all out anyway. So there's a little bit more magic to it. Also, they're not pillar boxed, so that's an advantage.
I suppose that makes sense.
Yeah, because I played after one of our podcasts, I downloaded Mortal Kombat 2 as part of like an arcade thing on Xbox after I spent, I think, an hour updating the Xbox because I hadn't used it in a year. Please update here. Please update here. Your password has been reset for security reasons. Please update here. God, it's just a pain in the butt. But anyway, once you finally got into it, I was like, I'm finally going to get to play. And then they had different modes to compensate for filtering they were trying to do to improve the original gameplay footage images. And they all kind of looked like shit, but it wasn't great. But the most offensive part was that they pillar boxed it, but on the sides it were the gold scroll Mortal Kombat lizard things over like marble granite stuff. you know what I'm talking about, that Photoshop painted whatever it is, airbrush stuff. And so they had that on either side, and those were sharper than the footage and sharper than the gameplay in the middle. So it was very distracting because you're looking at something out of the corner of your eye that is visually sharper than anything that you're actually supposed to be playing. So I don't know what the thinking was behind that. Just make those blurry. Who cares?
It's probably the best they could do. I apparently had Mortal Kombat 3. I thought I had 2, but not only do I have Mortal Kombat 3, in the box is a sticky note I wrote probably when I was 10 with all of the cheat codes to get all the extra fun stuff, like to turn on like the forever run and turn off the timer and, you know, all that fun stuff. So thanks, 10-year-old me, for writing down those cheat codes and not losing them and leaving them.
It's really exciting.
The other thing I was actually shocked by when I went to turn on the Nintendo and play is how absurdly fast it turns on and gets right into the game. Like modern technology, we have kind of like walked backwards in terms of our acceptance of lag, because you turn on a Super Nintendo from whenever the hell this thing was built and it is instantly on and ready to play.
Oh, yeah. I definitely noticed that every time I turn on my Xbox, which is why I seldom turn it on.
And it has my saved games, too. Like, there's no updating, no nothing. I just flip it on and I can pick up where I left off 20 years ago.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that is amazing to me as somebody who wants to play something, is that I don't need to spend the time to update it. And it's sort of one of those things that you kind of get in a way with iOS, because your game will update in the background, so you're not sitting there waiting for it to update necessarily. Which is nice. Also, I seldom play any games, so it works out okay. Like, I was playing Monument Valley again now that I got the iPhone 6, and...
Now that you can actually see it?
Well, no, I mean, I had played it originally on my iPad. So, I mean, it's a gorgeous game. It just looks very nice. Like, the color palette, the gradients, everything just renders very smoothly on the display. The touch targets are not super great, but... whatever, because tiny, tiny little doors. Anyway, but it's a great game, and I didn't need to, like, wait for the thing to, like, download anything or update anything. It was just there. It was already on my phone and ready to go. Now, I did need to actually wait for my phone to restore from backup, and that took a really long time, so that was the thing. That was an awful thing.
Mine's still restoring from Friday.
Are you being facetious?
No. It's still the lock screen still says restoring from iCloud backup.
Oh my god. Oh well, you're restoring from iCloud. I did it all through iTunes.
I'm struggling to figure out what it's doing though, because it seems done, except for the backup and restore application chewing up, I think, something on the average of 40% of my battery every day. But it's either downloading music or movies in the background, because I may have had movies on my previous phone, which they all show up there with the little cloud icon next to them in the videos app. But it's trying to do something. I'm not sure what, other than ruining my battery. Still, day three, restoring from iCloud.
Yeah, no, I had a 32 gigabyte iPhone 4, so it did not have any movies on it. it was mostly full of podcasts and some music and a ton of messages.
Yeah,
it is inconceivable to me how I sent so many messages with images in them, but I did.
I really like the new photo and voice message features.
I like the novelty of them. I don't really actually know if I'm going to use them in everyday life, but I do like, I've never had Siri on the phone before, so that's interesting. And it worked out really well now that it supports Shazam, because now I don't need to start up that god-awful app, which I hate. Shazam works actually much faster through Siri than it works through the app, mostly because you're not waiting for it to launch and load the advertisement it needs to show you and then say, hey, I want to run in the background forever, is that all right with you? And you say, no, of course not, why would I ever want that? So it's all good stuff, except they still have my home address wrong, so I can't use it for directions.
That's why, well, my rule of thumb is if it's in Los Angeles, use Google Maps.
Yes, no, and Google Maps has always worked correctly for my address, and when Apple Maps used to have Google underneath it in the original Maps app, that worked fine too. Ever since they switched over to Apple Maps, it has been wrong, and I have filed a report every 3 months or so where it just, I think, disappears into a black box somewhere in a void. They moved me out of the Four Seasons in Los Angeles, which was a good thing because I can't afford to stay there. But at the same time, the new address they gave me is not actually my address. And if I use the search feature, it takes me to a different address than that address. So if I use Siri for directions, it'll take me to the city of Los Angeles version of the street address instead of my city's version of the street address. And so it's baffling to me why that exists. And you can't really report that it only comes up for directions, but not for, I don't know. It's just one of those things where it's just like, you guys have had how many years and this thing is just atrociously, awfully terrible, and I get no feedback about any of this stuff I send to you?
Well, if I had to venture a guess as to why you were not getting any feedback, it is because literally everything in Los Angeles is wrong. I have used both Apple and Google Maps numerous times in Los Angeles, and not a single instance of Apple Maps mapping has ever been correct. So I think they kind of just need to like take all of the Los Angeles data and throw it in the trash can and start over. So they're probably, you know, bootstrapping that ground up, as it were.
Now, well, I will say this. They have gotten a lot of things. They have improved a lot of things over what it was initially at launch. In like the last year, especially like there used to be multiple search results for Los Angeles City Hall. So if you search for City Hall, you would get like three different Yelp reviews that weren't aggregated together into one thing, and they were all slightly at a different address. It didn't make any sense. Now you still get weird quirks in both Google Maps and in iOS where you say, hey, where's City Hall? And instead of being like, what city you're in, that city's City Hall, it's just like, what is something that is named City Hall that people look for? And it's like, oh, sure, I'll give you Los Angeles City Hall for Google Maps. And then for iOS, it gives me the City Hall in Philadelphia. and I have no idea why that
is. Or it's looking through your contacts for somebody named City Hall.
Yes. So it's such an awful thing. But let's steer this back away from technology since we're not a technology podcast.
Oh, man. Yeah, technology. One thing that probably looks way better on the fun new iPhone screen than the old CRT that I have hooked up to my Nintendo is today's lovely movie, Galaxy Quest. God, I hate doing that part of the podcast where we announce it. Sound like an announcer.
Well, I always usually do that with my bad segues, but I appreciate...
Well, you can make it intentionally bad, and I make it just, you know, bad because I'm bad at things.
Okay. Well, I was just trying to help you out there, buddy.
Well, keeping in this line of bad, this is going to be a bad episode because this movie is too good to say anything about. Like, what do you say? Like, go watch the movie because it's fun and good.
I can say lots of things about things that I like. And I also have apparently given this impression on Twitter that I only hate things. I don't know. Maybe it's my 50,000 word Doctor Who reviews or something. But I do actually like a lot of stuff that is out there. And Galaxy Quest is one of those things that I hold in very high regard.
On the criticism thing, do people still not understand that we criticize things that we want to like but are just like not almost quite there? We don't hate things. If we hated something, we wouldn't even mention it ever. But
well, I don't know, I hated Detention, but that's another story.
Well, you're wrong there. Mm-hmm. So that's you know, honestly, that's probably what it's restoring on my phone is Detention, because I think I usually keep that one fully downloaded
for emergencies.
Yeah, for emergencies, I need to whip out Detention and show it to somebody on my phone.
No, you don't understand the brilliance of this movie. Here, watch it.
More than once, I've referenced something that's in the movie, and that people just go, "What? I don't understand what you're saying." I just here, watch this.
Oh my god!
But anyway, Galaxy Quest is a movie that, you know, honestly, I haven't seen the beginning of the movie in so long because I think I just watch it whenever it's on TV. And I always manage to come in 30 minutes into it or something and just stick around to the end. So I know the end way better than I knew the beginning, but watch it all the way through this time. Amazon Prime streaming or Prime Instant Video, or whatever the hell they're called.
Yeah. Well, did you know that if you share like a family thing or whatever they call that service, that you can't actually use the Prime streaming? You can only use the shipping stuff.
No, I did not know that.
Fun fact. Anyway, so I watched it on my DVD, and it is still spectacular on DVD, regardless of any other thing, although I probably should just rebuy it on iTunes or something so I can have it in HD.
You know what I consider astounding about this movie is the man with the story and screenplay... Oh, sorry. The man with the story and screenplay credit has written exactly one thing, this movie.
Yes.
That blows my mind.
Yes. Well, I mean, Dave, I think some other person helped with the screenplay, too. And that person's written a lot more stuff. But apparently this needed a lot of help when it initially was written. It wasn't very similar to what you see on screen. And they also had different directors they were bringing in for it. At one point, Harold Ramis was going to be the director for it.
Oh, how great would that have been?
Well, he didn't want Tim Allen in the movie.
Really? Yes.
And after Harold Ramis saw the movie... he said that he was wrong and that Tim Allen would have been great in the movie, which I think is an interesting little factoid, because I honestly think the casting in this movie is brilliant and I wouldn't change a single person in it. This is the first time I ever saw Sam Rockwell.
Oh my God, how great is Sam Rockwell?
He's so good. He's ridiculous. And, you know, this Sigourney Weaver, actually demanded to be in this, which is crazy to think about, because you think she'd be so sick of science fiction stuff, but she actually loved the humor of being inside of this movie. And, you know, of course, Tim Allen, who plays a swaggering egomaniac, as well as anybody else can play a swaggering, you know, egomaniac.
Well, if the space shoe fits.
Mm-hmm. Look around for another shoe. But
it's actually a good part. I didn't remember that at all.
I love it. They just start staring at the ceiling. The whole thing is just like an amazing thing that shouldn't have come together at all, and nothing like it has been done since then. Like there's no Galaxy Quest 2 or something. And there's no other spin-off take on like trying to make this sort of a comedy. And it's very clearly a send-up of Star Trek. I don't think that could be any more clear in any other way that this is essentially a show about a 1980s Star Trek show that got canceled too soon or whatever. And the, Tim Allen standing in for William Shatner and Sigourney Weaver is kind of there for Uhura a little bit, but sort of also other characters. And, Alexander Dane, he's the character who would be Leonard Nimoy. And that's played by the brilliant Alan Rickman.
Alan Rickman is just...
He's too good, that guy.
Hans Gruber.
I was going to say Snape, but sure, Gruber, whatever. Fantasy.
Snape is that guy that I see all these memes of on Reddit.
Yes, that's what he's known for.
I presume he's in a movie of some sort. I have no idea.
Yes.
But the one thing I find fascinating about this movie is I think this is one of the first ones that I remember seeing where they're doing these sort of really on the nose calling out the tropes of their own genre, which is done more often these days. But back then, it really wasn't done as much. And this is probably a great example. I mean, where they don't overdo it, but there are definitely the subtle cues that where they're outright making fun of the genre of science fiction movies that they are now in.
Well, not just the genre of science fiction movies, but also science fiction fandom. A lot of this is about the fandom, about people that look up to other people who are inspired by sort of these messages of the future and teamwork and all this stuff. And they want.
I don't know about that message. The idea that it's okay to look up to these people because they can be heroes in their own way. That's kind of a secondary reason. I mean, it's there, but it's not really the reason I like this movie.
I wasn't saying it was the reason you like this movie. I don't care. But I was saying that fandom does come into play here, especially at the opening of the movie. We clearly establish that these people really love the show and it means a lot to them, and not just the people there at the convention. But the Thermians, who we are briefly introduced to, with their very interesting way of speaking. And we start to understand that this respect for the show is not shared by the actual cast members, who view it as a job, who view it as some way to get money, that for many of them, it has become something they are stereotyped and locked into. Is something that Alexander Dane, played by Alan Rickman, is especially resentful of. And so that is really very interesting and is directly parallel to the stuff in Star Trek, the original cast. Nimoy had a lot of stuff where he was really upset about always being Spock, which is kind of ridiculous to think about because it's like, how much more iconic could you be? But at the same time, they weren't making like a ton of money off of the old series being in syndication or anything. And they couldn't get new stuff because they were known for those roles.
Was Shatner nearly as into the fandom as Tim Allen's character would lead us to believe? I kind of, that's the one part about this that I don't really see, because he seems to still really be into the fandom in that it's kind of his golden goose, and he enjoys being idolized by all these people, and the crappy events that he's going to, he still seems to be super enjoying it at the beginning of this movie.
I will say this, I can't say that it's directly a one-to-one comparison for any of these characters, but it seems close. From a lot of stories, apparently William Shatner might be considered somewhat of a air quotes jerk, and that
well, yeah, that being called a jerk would lead me to believe that he's not super into people running up to him and asking for his autograph and talking to him about Star Trek stuff.
Well, he is, to a point. I mean, he's also done stuff in his past, like SNL skits and stuff where he's played off of the fact that, it's just a television show. Like, stop being so obsessed over this thing, which is more like what Tim Allen gets when he gets somewhat depressed by overhearing in the stall that people are there just to make fun of him.
Shatner probably doesn't handle it with the same grace as Alec Baldwin does when it did that, the Christmas parody of Glengarry Glen Ross. But anyway, yeah, that's, do you remember that
one? No.
He's, he's coming in to Santa's workshop to get the workers motivated, and they do the Glengarry Glen Ross speech again, but as elves.
Huh.
We'll have to find that for show notes. It's fantastic.
What is it, like eggnog is for closers?
Yeah, I think it might be, actually. But
that's too bad. Eggnog's disgusting.
I think there's even a line where he slips and he actually says something from the original speech instead of the elf version that he's supposed to be doing in this one.
That's funny. And of course, this gray cloud hangs over him the rest of the time as he goes home to his Hollywood Hills glass house and watches old reruns and gets wasted on scotch and passes out. And
I believe wholeheartedly. I think I think he pulled that straight out of his past. The blacked out without any pants on underneath your coffee table in your living room. But that was a good scene. Nice house.
Oh yeah. It's funny too to compare that to the apartments. At least I assume they're both apartments of Sigourney Weaver's character and Alan Rickman's character. Where Alan Rickman's character looks like he's in some sort of Hollywood 1940s New York set with like police action happening. It's very, very interesting. And her home seems kind of, well, normal. But we also established that there might have been something between Gwen's character and Tim Allen's character. Some spark that she obviously is sort of grossed out by at this point because he's super gross with the ladies and whatnot and his egotism. Which is important because you kind of can anticipate that maybe that'll change later in the movie. It's not subtle, but it's well executed. When the Thermians show up, and he thinks they're just some gig. He kind of goes along with a lot of it. And if he probably wasn't hungover, he might have noticed that there were some, you know, warning signs through this process, especially when her translator was broken and she just shrieked when she opened her mouth and that the limo was beamed into space. So there were a couple little things, but it was really interesting to see that unfold, this situation where we as the audience are completely aware that he's not in the situation that he thinks he's in. Set it to Screensaver 2, because right. He's so full of himself and thinks this is just some birthday gig for somebody.
We said it last week. It's always entertaining as an audience to watch when one character doesn't know something that the other characters or that we do know. So we watch Tim Allen stumble his way through this disastrous meeting with Saris and be beamed up into space. And he has no idea what the hell is happening until he gets ready to be fired through out of a jelly cannon back to Earth.
Yeah. And it is an extremely silly scene, but in 1989, those were like jaw-dropping effects in a movie theater.
Right.
It filled the whole frame of view, like seeing this intergalactic vista, this planet with rings around it and like nebula and black holes and stuff. Like it looked really impressive at the time, projected on a really large monitor. If you're watching the movie on an iPhone, I'm gonna imagine probably the least special looking thing that you've ever seen, but it kind of established some of the awe so that you believed the shock that Jason felt when this was unfolding. And of course we cut to him just shaking at his pool as the disc fades away underneath him and smoke is sort of fizzling around him. And we go to the event that he missed in Van Nuys.
I should give you credit. I didn't realize the quote that you put in that tweet last night was actually from the movie.
Oh yeah, of course it was. by Grapthar's hammer. What
a save.
Savings.
He just wants to kill himself.
He doesn't want to say it. I love it. And it is very funny. And the only person who's clearly very into this is Sam Rockwell's character, because he wasn't famous from the show, but wishes he had been, even though he was an extra that died. He wants sort of the fame that he thinks they have, and they, of course, just think he's kind of delusional. And so it works really well for plucky comic relief.
Yeah, he's one step up from the people who attend the actual conventions, because he was actually on the show for all of 2 seconds.
Yeah, and that's also why he's apparently there for the event at Tektronik's Value Superstore, which is delightful.
But yeah, his character is what I'm getting at when I say like they're poking fun at their own tropes, because, you know, he talks about multiple times how he was the unnamed crewman who died in episode 51 or whatever it was.
81.
81. Well, I thought he thought it was 81, but it was actually 51.
No. They just said that to make him feel better.
Oh, okay.
The plan was literally the plan from when he died.
Okay. Well, I love the fact that his character actually in this movie, his name is Guy.
Mm-hmm.
So they're doing the exact same thing to him, which is very nice.
What's my last name? I don't even have a last name. Mommy.
Oh, so good.
Yeah. I mean, he played this brilliantly. But it works because the rest of the ensemble plays their roles differently. If they had all been playing it like Guy, it wouldn't have worked out at all. And he also seems to have an awareness of situations that they lack, which comes in handy at a certain mining operation.
right.
But we get the scene where they swap boxes in the garage, and poor Justin Long's character, Brandon, is once again frustrated, and apparently it was his birthday that he was supposed to go to, that Tim Allen's character was supposed to go to.
Oh.
And went to the Thermians instead. And so he's quite sad. Poor guy. Poor Justin Long. Poor Mac. And so
was he you?
Moving right along. so they have they're all signing autographs, and Tim Allen comes up, and he looks like he's, well, just drunk and like wandered in.
I think the phrase you're looking for is hammered.
Yes, he doesn't look very good. So they all think that he's lost it, and they're so insulted by it that they can't stand him and just need to leave. And they all go back to their minivan they rented for this, apparently. And they almost leave before Fred Kwan, played by Tony Shalhoub, reminds them, you know, hey, it was a paying gig. When's the next time you think he's going to talk about a paying gig with us? And they go back inside the Super Value store, Value Supercenter, and inside is Lalari, the female that had been there previously. And she gives them some cryptic little speech about how they would like... Gwen gives them the speech about how they would like to go, you know, with the captain and stuff like that. And they work with the commander all together or not at all. And they all get blasted off.
She thinks she's getting another gig and they're trying to ride his coattails. But now you're going to be fired into space in a jelly cannon.
Mm-hmm. It works out super well because they land inside of the receiving bay or whatever. And they just hear shrieking. And then the doors open and octopus creatures come in. Thank you, Stan Winston. They have little metal things they're holding and waving around, and it's not supposed to really make any sense.
Yeah, and I like after the initial moment of shock after they're being probed, that Sam Rockwell just starts screaming. It just there's nothing else. He can't do anything. He just starts screaming.
I know. Oh, even when he lands, though, he is the most hunched, like neck scrunched up person of them all, and the most tense of all of them. He really gave it his all. and that shriek that it looked almost like Sigourney Weaver didn't know that was going to happen, because she even flinches on the side.
Oh, I'm sure, man. Yeah. I mean, when he goes full Sam Rockwell, I mean, it's magic happens. So
mm-hmm.
I'm sure the director just said, do it.
Mm-hmm. It worked out really well.
What was his history at this point?
I have no idea. I couldn't tell you. This was the first time I ever saw him.
Let's take a look at where this lands in his IMDb credits. Just after The Green Mile. Oh my god, really?
That's wow. It's one of Casey Liss's favorite movies to bring up on Analog.
Yeah, it's a good movie and all, but I wouldn't maybe to get the Green Mile off of him, he had to do a role like this. Good lord.
Well, this is a nice comedy. I've never seen The Green Mile. But
it's a very serious film, Joe.
I think it is, probably. The Thermians put on their like holographic cloaking identity, whatever things, and they say, "Oh well, sorry about that. Our bad. Let's all go meet everybody else." And so they wander off, and Jason's there, and he's like, "Oh, you guys are shocked," and because the roles are reversed now, where he's very comfortable with the situation, whereas he had quite literally just a few minutes before been much more in their situation.
Yeah, if there's one thing about this movie that doesn't actually make any sense, is the time compression where people go from super into stuff to super depressed to back to super into stuff, and then like the whole movie basically takes place in like 2 or 3 days, but the emotional swings go from one side of the pendulum to the other. But that's excusable because this is not that kind of movie. It's a fun movie, so we go along with it.
Yeah, there are a couple moments, well, particularly for time compression, because apparently he landed from his pod, went off and changed clothes, and came back and was totally fine with everything by this point.
Yeah, and he's ready to give him a tour of the ship and everything, like he knows.
Yeah,
like he knows they're at a spaceport or whatever. Yeah, okay.
But I can look past that pretty easily. You don't really notice that on first viewing anyways, I don't think. Much more if you like you're paying attention for that, I think. And so they go off on their little tour, and all of the Thermians are so wowed by the crew being there. And then when they get to Guy, they're just like, Guy. And they get in the little space elevator, and they go down to the ship, and they're all...
I was honestly surprised for people as fanatical as they were that they wouldn't have recognized Guy from his brief cameo.
Yeah, apparently. Maybe the mustache was new. I don't know. They never played a clip from episode 81, so I have no idea if he was just not recognizable. And so they get on the NSEA Protector, and there's this beautiful scene of them like going into the spaceport. And for 1999, again, I have to say, there wasn't really a lot of this going on in terms of the scale of special effects in this movie. Even Star Trek was pretty bare on the amount of effects they were putting in stuff. The contemporary Star Trek movie that came out at the same time as this was Star Trek Insurrection, which came out in 1998, and this came out in 1999. And that movie does not have a lot of wow factor for special effects. And so I really would say, like, for the time, you got to remember this stuff was awe-inspiring to see this ship. You sort of felt like as they feel inside of the elevator.
Yeah, and I think any of the cheesiness with like the rock monster, the little midget guys, it suits the feeling of the film, it being sort of this fun adventure. So I'm willing to excuse a lot more of that, except, you know, some of the rendering is a little iffy here and there. But, you know, the effects themselves, I think it looks great, especially within the context of this movie.
Yeah, and they get on the ship, and they're sort of surprised to find out that they expect the crew to take them out of the dock. And this is the famous scene with Laredo, Tommy Weber, Daryl Mitchell, piloting them into the side of the opening on the spaceport and scratching the crap out of the side of the ship.
Yeah, this is the realistic scene counterpart to that terrible one in Starship Troopers where what's her name does like the perfect last minute eject of the little tubes or whatever.
Oh God, Denise Richards.
But this scene is like the quintessential, like the overarching theme of this, which I think is hilarious, is that they rebuilt the ship based on what they sussed out of all of these episodes of the show. So that they used the show as their model for the user interface and the controls, rather than like using actual logic or anything or science or who knows what, or just, you know, using their technology. They built it around these goofy controls that some art director came up with in the 80s. And I think that is just hilarious that it's like, no, we based it off of everything that you did because we assumed you knew what you were doing. And now they have to basically try and remember how they were acting to figure out what they need to do.
Yes, and I think that's actually kind of funny. And it is a trope of Star Trek, where there have been races that have been influenced by technology that has been left behind by other people, sort of like cargo cultish. but this is obviously taken to an extreme, where they built the whole ship. And of course, they once they scrape the crap out of the side of the ship and get out into the into space, they go on their little mission and they have a nice little meal together with the Tetmoplitics.
How do you remember the names of all these things?
I just watched it like a couple hours ago.
So did I. I don't remember. I remember like blood ticks or something.
Dan, I don't know how to explain this to you, but if there's one thing that I am good at in life, it is remembering the most obscure, asinine, pointless things from science fiction, television,
see,
and
movies.
I'm over
here like Tim Allen getting ready to call them termites or whatever. I don't remember what they were actually called.
Yeah, the termites and the Dalmatians. But they get on, they're in the cafeteria enjoying their nice little meal, and he's got his steak and he's got his ticks. And we start to get the hint that maybe this wasn't a good idea to play this little con, because Mathazar plays the recording of their previous commander when one of their own had tried to lead them. And it is an incredibly sad scene where one of the octopus puppets is being electrocuted to death. And it's very clear that Saris does not really have a lot of empathy. I don't know how they got the quote unquote tape off of the ship, but whatever. We cut to this hilarious scene of them all running down the hallway. And Mathazar catches up to them to point out that maybe they shouldn't get in the pods, because Saris will surely detonate anything leaving the ship right now because he's here. And they all get to go to the bridge, and it's all on them.
It's all very tightly timed in terms of the story, the points that the things need to happen. But it works now, because, you know, every natural instinct you'd have as a human being to say, well, they should probably just run away now. And you go, no, we can't do that now because of this new plot point that we get to deal with, which is good writing.
Yeah, well, it's good because it doesn't let them get out of their lie just yet. Because it would have been a little too tidy if they had been able to blast off and then think about this. Like, of course they can't do it. And of course the reason why they can't is because they're immediately faced with the person that they're ostensibly there to deal with, Saris. And it is probably one of the most hilarious scenes with Tim Allen saying that he wants to cut the transmission by striking his finger across his neck, and Sigourney Weaver striking her finger across her neck and nodding. But it's because of two different things. And then Tim Allen goes back to talk to Guy about how he's supposed to fire the different particle cannons. And, you know, the guy is as stupid as he is ugly. And the whole entire time, Sigourney Weaver is saying, Jason. And then he finally turns around and she says, well, you have been on with him the whole entire time. And he says, perhaps I'm not as stupid as I am ugly, Commander. And
I love that her excuse is like, what? I know where the mute button is. We just walked in here.
Yeah, like I know where the hold button is. Which is funny, because they also cut to a small little moment of Alan Rickman rolling his eyes. which I love. That's the cherry on top of that sundae.
Yeah, Alan Rickman cannot be bothered until he actually meets somebody who was genuinely moved to do great things with their life by his performance on the show, which is him being a dramatic actor is all he could ever ask for in the first place.
Yeah, and that works out so well for his character, really. I mean, but here he plays someone that I could identify more with, which is the person who takes this all seriously and who maybe is a little negative. You know, like,
maybe it's a little negative.
You don't hold down on the turbo button. It's for quick boosts. And they broke the ship.
That's just common knowledge. Anyone who's ever played video games knows you don't hold the turbo button. If you do, you're going to run out of juice.
Yeah. I mean, didn't this guy have a 480 XDX? Anyway, so.
Wait. Quick side tangent. What was the name of that game where you played like little hovering race cars that went around a track? It's like super futuristic looking.
Was that F-Zero?
Oh my god, yes it was.
Okay, I didn't play it.
I haven't thought of that game in a very, very long time. Anyway, we can continue with Galaxy Quest.
Oh, well, this is a good tangent? Well, because they race away, and that's good because
and they break their beryllium sphere.
Yes, it's so funny. And what you're forgetting the wonderful minefield scene, where they fly through a minefield where the mines are magnetically attracted to the ship, which is an important plot point. And they get out on the other side. And
again, a moment in the movie where they're making fun of themselves in that this is such a ridiculous thing to ever exist for any purpose ever that, of course, it actually exists. Somebody would have built a magnetic minefield for some war years ago, and well, also, it's still just sitting out there.
Yeah, it doesn't really make a lot of sense because what did they mine exactly? It's just this cloud around nothing.
Oh, no, it makes no sense whatsoever, but it's totally the kind of thing that would have been like in a Star Trek episode.
Yeah, exactly. And so,
why not just go around it? Just go up or down or left or right, any of them.
Yeah, I'm not sure that might have been what Saris did. It's not clear to me.
It doesn't matter, but that's what any normal human being would do.
And but it's hilarious, though, once they finally get on the other side and they have their meeting in the conference room, and she's repeating the computer. And she's scolded, and she's like, I have one lousy job on this ship, and it's stupid, but I'm going to do it, which is good for her. Good job, Sigourney Weaver.
Mm-hmm. She demands the respect that everyone else is getting in this fake world where everyone thinks they are who they're not really.
Yeah, especially when she's trying to explain that they're actors, and they're talking about television shows, and she says, you don't think Gilligan's Island is real? And Mathisar just looks down. He's just like, those poor people.
This is great.
This is very clear that it's just going to be very difficult to explain this. Like, there's no easy out for them at this point.
I mean, I know they got stranded, but they didn't really have the hardest of lives. You know, they had radios made out of coconuts and stuff.
Yeah. I think it was more for the movie to play it up in that fashion than it made any logical sense. But yes, I'm willing to forgive their creative license. it's just wonderful. And they have to, we get the scene with Tony Shalhoub calling in and saying, oh, well, the guys think they found a beryllium sphere we can go get down on a planet. So let's go do that. And then they have a little group hug at the end, which is,
yeah, I love that Tony Shalhoub's character is just so like beyond unfazed by any of this. He's just kind of like, well, you know, here we are, we're gonna do our thing. And I love that moment where he's like, that was right again, guys, come on, group hug, let's bring it in here.
he legitimately seems high, which I think was the intention, that very purposeful that he was playing it that way. And
because Scotty was a drunk.
Your words, not mine.
I'm asking. You're the one who knows the canon better than I do.
I have no idea. I don't think that's actually true. But I mean, there was a scene where Scotty does outdrink someone for reasons, but it's not germane. Anyway, moving on. So they do this whole thing, to get to the planet. They send down the little shuttlecraft, and we establish, Quillick. The character who we had seen before, but he hadn't really talked to anybody before. And he talks to Alexander Dane, played by Alan Rickman, about how inspirational his character of Dr. Lazarus was, like how he tries to live his life by the rules that Dr. Lazarus lived by, which is endearing, except that Alexander Dane flatly rejects the premise that anyone should live life by the ridiculous rules of that television show. And he's still, of course, resentful of the ridiculous typecasting for himself. So he's not very nice to Quillick in that scene.
Yeah, he hasn't yet come to terms with the fact that he has done some good as his character.
Yeah. And so they go down to the planet. We have it's your typical, like, Southern California desert rocks and stuff. And
except for the beryllium mine.
Yeah, the beryllium mine. Oh, boy. So funny. And the miners come out, and yeah, they look like they're three. No, miners, not miners. It's all good stuff. And a guy, of course, stops Sigourney Weaver from going out behind the rock to help the little injured one. And he's like, didn't you guys ever watch the show?
And she's they're like, gonna get all mean and something bad's gonna happen.
Yeah, they're gonna have a million teeth. There's gonna be a million more of them. And sure enough, Guy is absolutely 100% correct. And the situation does not go well for the poor little injured guy. And he gets eaten. And if you watch the scene closely, you'll see body parts being flung in the air, which is an interesting, bold move for a PG-13 movie. So they dismembered that aquatic Smurf in the desert or whatever, and they all panic and they talk to each other about the situation. But they don't pay attention to the little creature things. And so when they turn around and they're gone, they're just not really sure what to do. And they send Laredo and Guy off to monitor the situation while the rest of them go get the beryllium sphere. And Jason Nesmith does his little roll. And Gwen asks, does the rolling help?
And he drops his gun.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah.
Hilarious. And so
up until this point, everything they've done on the show has been to the success of this. They built a spaceship based on the show. So why not, keep it up? His character rolls.
Yes. Well, it's part of, I think, the ridiculousness of the situation. They don't see themselves really. Like they start to blend into the characters. At least Jason does here.
We missed the other moment where they were getting off of the little ship on the planet, and guy Sam Rockwell character basically says, "Wait, what are you doing? Don't open that! This is an alien planet. Is there air? You don't know." And Tony Shalhoub just starts sniffing and goes, "It's fine. It looks fine to me." And then just walks out.
Yeah. Well, the thing I love about that is Guy holds his breath.
Exactly.
Like that would have done anything.
Well, as we established in Guardians of the Galaxy, when you're out in space, all you have to do is hold your breath, and if you're out there too long, you'll freeze, but you won't die.
Don't invoke our most hated episode when we're discussing something so delightful.
Don't invoke ridiculous, stupid. Never mind.
So anyway, they get the sphere back on the little shuttle thing, and then for some reason, Tim Allen feels like he can't make it over the thing. And
well, yeah, he doesn't fit because the thing takes up too much space.
He really should have tried harder.
Maybe they could have measured the ship beforehand or something. Ah, who knows?
Yeah, well, I don't think they were planning to leave in a panic quite like that. And the shuttle goes, and they're on autopilot, so they can't stop and get him. And of course, Alexander Dane is extremely resentful of the situation because, of course, it has to be him. This stays behind. And
he's got
to
be the hero.
Yeah, and they...
But it's funny because he's actually being the hero.
Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, just sort of comedic, of course, because the situation doesn't really call for his resentment because he should probably be just slightly more concerned that someone was going to die.
Yeah, and I like that they don't have like a switch that flips or whatever where they go like, all right, now we're going to take this seriously and we're going to be these characters. It's like a series of moments where they're like playing around and doing this and that, but they all gradually, through the course of their own actions, become, you know, the person they need to be in the given moment. It's not just like, all right, guys, let's say out loud and make up a moment where we decide we're going to be serious now. They actually do it as a course of their actions, which is really well done.
Yeah, yeah. And they... And a good example of that is when Fred has to use the digital conveyor when they get back onto the ship. And up to this point, Fred had been very zen about everything, but maybe his high is wearing off or something because he
left his stash back on Earth.
Yeah, he's suddenly very paranoid and concerned about having to operate this thing.
Well, I hear that's a side effect.
Yes, yes. Turning pig lizards inside out, probably not as much of a side effect. everything's fine.
If your pig lizard turns inside out within 4 hours, please see a physician.
Oh, good. Everything's fine, but the animal's inside out. It turned inside out, and then it exploded.
And then it exploded, right. It's probably not... It doesn't bode well.
No. And then they figure out some... This is kind of silly. They figure this out, that the word they were... The alien creatures were shouting was actually rock. And then the... rock monster appears, and it's good that the shot's a lock off because then it makes it easier to roto. So good for them.
The rock guy was definitely a scene. Let's get visual effects-y for a moment where Tim Allen seemed almost entirely shot on blue screen, if I would have guessed.
Well, I think there are some parts, if you look at his neck, that are kind of like cut out feeling. So I don't really know if it was either just a really tight roto or a really tight blue screen. It did seem that he didn't have any sort of like spill contamination or anything on him. So it almost looked like he was shot with the rocks.
He was super heavily backlit. So it looked to me like he was blue screened in, and just at least in the wide shots, you know, the initial shot where the rock monster pops out. But maybe in some of the tighter ones he was. But like the one where he's flying through the air after he got tossed, that might have been practical. But like a couple of them definitely seemed blue screened in for me.
Yeah, well, what you gonna do? And but this, you know, overall it works because it's kind of funny because rock monsters on science fiction shows, we're always guys in rubber suits. So it's
yeah, and the rock monster is totally not the point of this scene.
Yeah, but the comedy of the scene is trying to deal with the rock monster. You know, he's being told to kill it, and he's open to suggestions. And there's a joke in here, which is a Star Trek joke. Just to look around and see if you can construct a weapon.
Yes, fashion a weapon of some sort.
Yeah, can you make some sort of rudimentary lathe? which is just hilarious. Because in one episode, Kirk does make a cannon out of like a bamboo shoot and some powder. And
that's
then kill...
right, they did that on Mythbusters.
Yeah, it's pretty silly. They finally, you know, we get the "we believe in you" moment. You can do it. You can do it, Fred. And Fred beams him up to the ship. Everything's fine. He's not inside out. Somehow his shirt came up with him, which is good because then he can put it back on. And
yeah.
We have the scene where they realize that while they were distracted by all of this, the ship was taken over by Saris, which is not probably a good thing. And they find Mathazar being interrogated, and it's kind of a sad scene because now we finally do need to come to terms with the fact that they have just been lying to Mathazar the entire time. And you see Mathazar get crushed by this, and Saris gleeful that he has crushed Mathazar and the Thermians, and that he's going to blow up the ship, and he's going to remove all of the air for our lovely Thermians and their little crew deck. Which is very little now, which was much bigger earlier when it was another scene.
Well, it was a different one. They locked him in the closet or whatever. But
yeah, this is just like the smaller annex for the overflow.
Sure. It's interesting. The Thermians, with their lack of understanding of deception and this and that, they're kind of, to pull out Guardians of the Galaxy again, they're kind of, what's his name? Guy who takes everything literally.
Yeah, well, and they do take everything literally. To their detriment, poor guys. And I mean,
they're not quite as angsty as why can't I think of his name?
I don't know. Why can't you think of his name?
What's his name? Guy, the red guy from Guardians of the Galaxy. Do I have to look it up?
I mean, Drax the Destroyer.
Yeah, there you go, okay. Drax.
Yeah. Yeah,
cut that out.
They're not as angsty, and they don't break anything. But I really have to give hats off to Enrico Colantoni here for his performance as Mathazar. It doesn't make any sense why his holographic suit would have damage on his skin, but whatever. I'm willing to look past it. It's a very affecting moment where he sees that he's been lied to the entire time, and that his whole race is going to be destroyed because of it. Jason and the others are not willing to give up quite yet, though. And when they're being escorted to the airlock to be spaced, they once again refer to the show to actually get them out of the situation they're in. And we get a nice little moment with Alexander Dane also participating in this, and they assist one another in getting out of it. And very hilariously sending the henchmen into space, where they will turn up again later. And it's just, it's very nice. And the team splits up to accomplish their little tasks. We get the whole scene with Jason and Gwen trying to rectify things with Brandon, how everything's all real. And he knew it all along. He knew it wasn't just a television show. And they're going to...
Are you still waiting for that call?
Shut up, man. And so they get through the ducts and they go down, and it's all ridiculous. And the chomper scene is one of my favorite scenes.
Yeah.
Because it makes fun of a completely silly trope of these science fiction shows, where there were parts of these ships that were obviously just there for like drama for an episode, like that obviously made no sense, and they took it to the very farthest extreme you could possibly take that to, with giant crushing steel blocks sliding in and out and a wall of fire, which seemed to serve no actual purpose, but the Thermians built it because it was in the show.
Of course. And which is exactly what Justin Long was there to talk to him about, some inconsistencies between episodes and the blueprints.
Yeah. So I don't know if that actually is an inconsistency on the ship. but thank goodness Justin Long was knowledgeable enough to point this out.
It's a good thing they didn't change art directors, like, you know, through one of the seasons and just mix everything up, because then, you know, whose blueprints would they have built it off of?
Well, so they get through the whole situation, they get to the thing, they turn it off. Tony Shalhoub's character beams up the rock monster to beat the crap out of all of the guys using the digital conveyor, and it's a nice moment where they're able to use their science fiction knowledge to aid themselves, and we get Quillick and Alexander Dane working together to try and get the Thermians out of the area that they're in, but they do that rather ineffectually. But it helps that once the air pressure is equalized, the door is open, they go in, and then Quillick is shot. He has this very Shakespearean, "I am shot," and then falls over. and I have to give him bonus points for collapsing like that, because that looks amazing if you watch it. He just like drops like a sack of potatoes. it is pretty rough. This is finally when the switch flips for Alexander Dane, where he realizes that it was just a show to him, but to this person, it had inspired him to do something, and to make something of himself. And so he looks up to Alexander Dane as a father, and he even says that when he's dying. And this deeply affects Alexander Dane, and he goes out and beats the crap out of the poor unsuspecting henchman who has a malfunctioning gun, fortunately. It all works very smoothly, and we almost get a confession of love between Gwen and Jason Nesmith, but that's just because they thought they were going to blow up. And turns out that it's just because on the show the timer's always stopped at one, so of course the timer actually stops at one. It had been diffused far before then, and they all make their way back up to the bridge to get the heck out of Dodge and fix everything. And it's really nice that by this point in the movie they've all figured it out, and they can all capably pull off the roles, and it balances perfectly with the scene earlier in the movie when they first met Saris, where they didn't know what they were doing and they made a total disaster of everything. And they go back through the same minefield, and they use it to their advantage in taking down Saris. It really redeems all of them for how awful they were by pretending to actually be the crew of the NSEA Protector and pretending it was a real thing.
Because now it is real, because they have actually embodied those roles and done the things that everyone thought they had done.
Yes. And it's beautiful. At that point in the movie, you're just like, yeah, cheer them on. Unfortunately, Saris somehow beams off of the ship that is exploding and onto their ship. And we get the point where the Omega 13 they had been talking about the whole movie finally comes to actually do something, because, you know, Chekhov's law of omega 13s, you put a
an omega 13 on the mantle,
yeah, in the first act, and then it gets fired in the third act, and then it does get fired. They use it to defeat Saris, who once again had outwitted them and got on the ship, and it resets time, and Jason is able to incapacitate him, and they're all able to make it work out. Which is good. It's very nice that happens.
It's very good that happens, yes.
Yes, but my problem with that is immediately after that scene, they're faced with a situation where the ship won't be able to slow down in time unless they separate, which doesn't make any sense. And so they separate, and then they're going to go crash land at the convention center, which would be fine, except once they... Justin Long is going to guide them with Roman candles, you know, Flight of the Navigator style.
Yeah, that was lovely.
Yeah, and the mom's just happy he's going to be out of the house. And it's nice, but once they crash and Saris is still alive and comes out of the ship, then it's just like, okay, you can't do that many times. Like, he can't be not dead that many times. It's a little silly.
I loved that in this moment when they chose to actually kill him and vaporize him with the gun, that he explodes in the cheesiest poof of, like, stage magic you've ever seen.
Well, yeah, and that's actually, I have to think that was intentional, because everything else
totally
is executed, you know, differently than that. So I definitely think that was intentional, where his body mass does not make up the mass of the explosion that occurs.
No, it's just like a little poof of, like, yeah, smoke and fire. And it's hilarious.
Yeah, and the Guy Fliegman role is played by a different presenter who doesn't really recognize any of the people coming out of the ship and gives them a nice little introduction.
It's Kevin McDonald. You can give him a name.
Well, I just forgot Kevin McDonald's name for a second.
How could you?
I can't remember everything. I can tell you something else though, Dan.
What?
Remember Lathe, the lieutenant for Saris?
No.
Okay.
Remember the one with the head on the stick?
No, not the dead lieutenant. The lieutenant that was his successor.
Sure.
Remember when he's like, we can't get on their tail because they're coming right towards us. Remember that guy?
Yeah, that guy.
Yeah. That was played by Wayne Perry, who was in Pirates of Silicon Valley. And he played Captain Crunch in that, apparently. It's all coming together, Dan.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Did I ever tell you about the time I went to the Kids in the Hall show and they did the smashing your head bit and they smashed my head?
No.
I'll save that for another time.
Okay. Is there a clip of it?
He was using the video camera as a prop, so like through his video camera would be up on the big screen, you could see him doing the forced perspective smashing your head, and I was like in the third row, so everyone there saw it. I don't know if they recorded that. It was like they did a tour I think it was well after the show, but they did like one last episode or one last showing of the live show where they would do bits from the show, and that was one of them, and he smashed my head.
Oh, that's amazing.
It was funny. Like, I was so uncomfortable with it because he was, you know, like yelling at me. He's like, get up, get out of here, you. And he was like making fun of my shirt or whatever. And I was so like off put. I almost stood up and like walked out of my seat because that's what he was telling me to do. But then luckily I didn't. And then he proceeded to smash my head because I was being unresponsive.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was the point of the bit.
Yeah, I know. But I almost ruined it by getting up and walking out.
Well, it's a good thing you didn't ruin that thing, Dan. you gotta leave something unruined in your life.
I don't think we ruined this movie.
Oh no, nothing can ruin this movie. I love this movie.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yes,
it is a bit kind of funny to think about the fact that they smashed all those cars and they crashed a spaceship into the side of a convention center, and nobody's really gonna say anything about that.
No, but they're all fans. They died for the cause.
Yeah, I know, but like the police outside, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, well, we get the teaser of the fact that the show is going to go back on the air now. But we don't get the repercussions of, you know, what happened. Like, what does a crashed alien ship mean for the people of Earth?
It was just a stunt that went terribly wrong.
Yeah, who really cares about that at that point? It's just the fact that the show will be back on the air and that Guy Fliegman will be Rock Ingersoll, security chief. It's just like, I love it because it's just like, how could I make my name the longest name ever so I won't die?
Yeah, he's got like his gold chains on and his greasy slick back hair and
in the cheese ball smile when it comes
out.
Yeah,
of course.
It's so good. I love this movie so much. And it is uplifting, but also it's very a technically well-made workmanlike film where things in the beginning are mirrored at the end. Everything ties up nicely. There's a bow on the whole thing. Like, it works out really well. I can't say enough nice things about this film. I find it infinitely quotable. I even love the score by David Newman, who does his best bombastic Star Trek score he can muster. Because that's really what's called for here. And it works out splendidly. Some of Stan Winston's animatronic stuff gets a little away from him with, like, crab claws and stuff, But it's fine. Like,
well, I heard somewhere, it was probably on another podcast, that like they only had like three of the functioning Saris guys, like masks or robot heads or whatever, and the rest of them just didn't function. That's why they kind of like traded them out here and there. So most of them were just kind of static.
Yeah, well, that's also why so many of the henchmen have something covering their faces.
Yes.
They're just completely covered in armor, which we also referenced in the Guardians of the Galaxy episode for those other henchmen who are completely covered in armor, except for that one scene where you see one of their mouths. And that's because it's expensive. So good for them.
It's so much cheesier, and there were so many more limitations in this movie. And yet, I'm not going to make a Guardians of the Galaxy comparison and lose more listeners.
Please don't do that. Everybody's going to be like, how can you say something bad about Rocket Raccoon? He's the best. Oh my God. OMG. We hate you. You guys are mean.
No. Sigourney Weaver is the best.
Sigourney Weaver is wonderful. And I think that she has a tremendous sense of humor about herself. And if you see films like Heartbreakers, then that's even more abundant. Of course, that's kind of hard to watch with Jennifer Love Hewitt in it, but it's
Is that the one with Ray Liotta's in that too?
Yes, Ray Liotta, and I think Gene Hackman is in it. It is a marvel of modern filmmaking. For I don't know,
pretty sure marvel is not the word for that.
No, I'm pretty sure I used that term incorrectly. But I really liked it. Is there anything else you would like to conclude with? Any personal experiences about how deeply this affected your love of Star Trek?
I did not watch Star Trek. Never have. Probably never will. But this movie, I get the references. I get the jokes just because Star Trek is pervasive in society, and at least to a point where I would understand the jokes, or at least enough of the jokes to enjoy this movie. But yeah, this is a super fun movie to watch pretty much whenever it's on.
Yeah, I went to one Star Trek convention when I was a kid. I think I might have been like 10.
What did you wear?
Oh, my mom had stitched one of those teal jersey sweaters. She had stitched the black thing across the top so that it looked like one of those TNG outfits for like one of the medical officers.
Mm.
So I wore that to it. Another Halloween, I was Spock. So that's a different story.
I had a Ghostbusters uniform and a little plastic proton pack.
For Halloween or just for fun?
Just for fun. I probably wore it for Halloween when I was crazy young, but like there's a picture of me like 6 years old or something running around with that. I also had the trap too.
Oh, that's nice. I always wanted that.
Yeah.
Well, from the commercials, they were very inspiring.
I also I dressed up as a Mortal Kombat character 1 year for Halloween.
Which character?
I'm pretty sure I was Reptile. I mean, it was the Sub-Zero outfit, but I was green, I think.
Okay, well, that would have been Reptile.
Yeah.
And for the convention, I actually did get to ask a question of Gates McFadden, who played Dr. Crusher on The Next Generation. And this was at, I think, the Hollywood Inn in Tampa near the airport. And, or the Doubletree. I think it was Holiday Inn, though. And
my God. I'm sorry. The fact that you're... Never mind. What was your question?
Well, I asked her a very stupid question. I mean... In my head, it wasn't stupid, because what I meant was, how do the props for the tricorder work? Like, what are you doing to make that all function? And what I actually ended up saying was, how do the tricorders work? Which is a very charming thing for a 10-year-old to say, and Gates handled it very well by saying, oh, they don't really work. It's, you know, it's a television show, but blah, 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 blah. And so that was mildly embarrassing for me.
I love that at 10 you were actually interested in the technical workings of the prop.
Well, that's because I had also seen The Reading Rainbow by this point, where they had explained all the special effects.
Oh my gosh.
Haven't you seen The Reading Rainbow, where he explains all the special effects, how they do the transporter and how they filmed the miniature upside down because the saucer was too heavy for the drive section, so they couldn't film it the other way?
I must have missed that episode.
Okay. Well, it was important, and I think it's on YouTube.
Would it be safe to say that you were a bit of a super fan?
Trekker, not a Trek-E. Thank you very much. And
so,
yes. what is the Klingon word for loneliness? But the whole thing was a point in my life, and so I'd always wanted to go to the Las Vegas Star Trek experience too. but I didn't make it before they actually closed it down, and so I can never do that, and it makes me sad.
I was over at the Hilton by the convention center, wasn't it? It was.
Okay. Well, I mean, you don't like the show, so I can only imagine that you've
No. You see the sign walking past it on your way to the convention center, and that's where NAB is held.
Jerk. And well, that was fine. And then I also did with my dad and my sister and my brother and stepmom, we went to Universal Studios and did the Star Trek thing where they shoot you against a blue screen on a little blue screen set, and they insert you with footage of real actors from the movies. So we have a VHS of like a fake interaction with me and Kirk and Spock.
Will they give you lines?
Yeah, we had to read the lines, and then they'd play, you know, of course, the actual actors. And it was on it was supposed to be a training mission, ostensibly. Like, there's a million of these. You can look them up on YouTube. I don't have mine digitized, and I have no plans to.
Is it footage specifically made for the ride?
Oh, yeah, just made for this thing. And it's super cheeseball.
Nice.
Like, the cheesiest cheeseball stuff. And I was the trainee captain. So that was fun. And for some reason, we had thermal detonators as a prop. So that was a little Star Wars-y, but I'm willing to look past it. And there was a little intro from Gene Roddenberry.
Willing to look past it.
Yeah. Well, I'm very forgiving. I like Star Wars, too. Okay, so I think this episode clearly establishes that I like some things. And I'm very happy about
that. I think it establishes that you like some things so strongly that you have no room in your heart for other things.
Well, that's not my fault. They should just be more like Star Trek. That's all they need to do.
Be more like Star Trek.
Yeah.
Your love has limits.
My love has a final frontier.